Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. I am having so much fun after 15 years on the air. I still get to interview my heroes like Ambassador Alan Keyes a couple weeks ago, Judge Roy Moore, and now today a scientist who worked for 20 years at one of our national labs, the Los Alamos National Laboratory, and he's now with the Institute for Creation Research. What an honor to speak with Dr. John Baumgartner, who is coming Saturday to a conference in Denver to speak about evidence for a young Earth. Dr. Baumgartner, welcome to Bob Enyart Live.
Thank you very much, Bob.
This is exciting. Quite a few of my friends, folks at Denver Bible Church and people in this audience, are coming out to the conference on Saturday. We've talked about it. We did the whole show on Friday with a local creation speaker. But could you tell us about this conference? I haven't ever been to an ICR conference.
Okay, the conference is focused on the issue of the age of the Earth, and in particular on the issue of radioisotope methods, which most people have been led to believe demonstrate without any serious doubt that the Earth is billions of years old.
Mm-hmm.
What we will show in our conference is that radioisotope data instead argues strongly, compellingly, for a young Earth only a few thousand years old.
Wow. And
as astonishing as that might sound to most people.
Yeah, that is exciting. I've got a friend, one of our church members, he owns an entire mountain in Colorado. It's pretty fun. We call it Arts Mountain. And he did oil exploration in his day. And we'd walk out on the mountain and he'd say, Bob, how can this only be thousands of years old? And then he started to look at all the young Earth creation science. Now he buys our young Earth creation science materials and gives them out to his business partners. So there is a lot of evidence, hardcore scientific evidence, to back up the Christian worldview that we were specially created by God in the recent past.
Right. And also that there's been a recent global flood cataclysm just a few thousand years ago that dramatically changed the face of the Earth, completely renovated the Earth's surface.
And you are known, Dr. Baumgartner, for your work on computer modeling. By the way, I used to work for McDonnell Douglas Helicopter Company in their simulation department on the Apache helicopter. So I've got a little bit of a background in computer science. But you did 3D computer modeling of the mantle of the Earth and how it would react during catastrophes. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's back in the late 70s, as a result of doing quite a bit of lecturing and debates on the creation evolution issue, had some time to focus on the question of how does plate tectonics fit into a biblical understanding of Earth history. And it was like an epiphany in when I realized that the flood had to be primarily a tectonic catastrophe and had to involve, in a very significant way, the interior of the Earth. So not only was the surface of the Earth affected, the interior of the Earth participated as well in this catastrophe. And
well, the book of Genesis, before it mentions rain coming down, it speaks of the fountains of the great deep broke open.
So, that's right.
So
pulled apart in a dramatic way, and fountains like people could hardly imagine broke forth as the hot rock came in contact with ocean water and violently produced violent steam jets coming up at supersonic velocity up through the oceans, ripping as that steam ripped up through the several mile thickness of ocean water, carried up with it a huge amount of liquid water, which then fell down as intense global rain.
Mm-hmm. And these ideas, some people might have only heard of this kind of idea from the pages of the Bible, but many people in the audience might not realize that there is a world filled with evidence of this global catastrophe. And in fact, the major mountain ranges of the world, they have seashell fossils on their summits, and this is all over the world.
Yes, there's actually the greater part of the fossil record consists of very widespread blankets of sedimentary rock, fossil-bearing sedimentary rock. There are no modern analogs to these types of geological formations, like one sees exposed in the Grand Canyon, in the walls of the Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. Such formations are simply not being formed today. And yet, geology for well over 150 years, 170 years, has been claiming that present-day processes acting at approximately present-day rates are able to explain this record. It's simply false. That is a failed effort to make that kind of interpretation match what we actually see in the field.
Well, and it seems like the National Geographic and Nature, Nova on public TV, so often they give examples where they're starting to admit that major geologic features happened in minutes and hours and days rather than millions of years. Two recent ones are the Heart Mountain Detachment at Yellowstone, where a mountain came apart, and now they're saying it happened in minutes, not in millions of years. And the Scablands in the state of Washington, Nova just did a major special saying this didn't happen over millions of years, it happened over hours.
That's right. A major ice age lake, a dam broke, ice dam broke, and a huge volume of water in this lake in Montana went spilling down slope and scoured these canyons in eastern Washington and part of Oregon in just a matter of hours, and just incredible erosion.
It seems like it was a gut reaction for over a century now of geologists, secular geologists. When they see some feature on the surface of the Earth, they just automatically say, oh, that took millions of years to form. But then as they start to look at the hard evidence, the evidence is there that these things formed rapidly, and we have a lot of fun with that. There are these nodules that are on the floor of the oceans, and we were watching a World Almanac documentary on these nodules, and they said they formed over millions of years, except one marine geologist, came on the show, and he said, well, actually, we found one of these formed around a beer can, so we know they obviously can form rapidly. And that was a kick.
Right, right. Well, there's these black smokers. It's obvious that there are lots of dissolved chemicals, in this case, various kinds of metal sulfides, that are coming up as a result of this hot water circulating in the hot ocean crust that's recently formed. It's not surprising that sulfide material settles out around the vents, hundreds of feet at most, in some cases, from the vents, that you can form these nodules in a short period of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was pretty neat to see that. We were watching that with our kids, and I thought, okay, here we go again, the millions of years. And we were so thankful that one scientist came on and said, actually, they've been known to form around beer cans. So now my son, Zachary, 9 years old, will be there Saturday at the conference. He's excited, Dr. Baumgartner, that you're going to be there because he knows about you because of the Jonathan Park Adventure Series, the creation audio programs on CD put out down in Texas by our friends, Howard Phillips' son. Doug Phillips runs Vision Forum in Texas. You have a guest appearance on one of the Jonathan Park programs.
Well, people have told me that. I might have done. Was that a live interview?
It was a. Here was the plot of the show. It's a family who's opening up a creation museum. By the way, they're tremendous. The production quality is great. It's like VeggieTales, but for the radio. Okay. And it's all creation and young earth. And in one of the episodes, the family that's opening up a creation museum, the son is invited to go on the radio. And so they get some scientists to call in during the program, and you're one of them. So from your side in the real world, they probably called and did a radio interview with you. And now that's an important part of this tremendous Jonathan Park audio series.
Well, I'm glad I could encourage a few people.
Yeah, you really have. And by the way, that is very popular. It's selling all over the country. It's really a great, great series. Hey, two things about us here at Bob and Yurt Live. I've probably mentioned you and your work on this show on 100 different programs over the last 15 years, but I'm sure you don't know about us. And just two things I'd like to tell you. I don't know if you know Reasons to Believe, Hugh Ross.
Sure.
And how about Eugenie Scott, Dr. Eugenie?
Sure. I know her on a personal level.
Yes, and I do too, basically. We debated Eugenie, a one-hour debate, about 10 years ago. It was me against Eugenie Scott. She's a physical anthropologist, and she's an anti-creationist. That's what she does full time. And we had a great debate. We're selling it. We sell it ever since then. And her number one argument against creation, in fact, it was the only argument she would make that full hour, was junk DNA. And here we are a decade later, and the evolutionist scientists are saying that junk DNA is not junk. It's very sophisticated.
That's right. Just in the last few months, the research from the ENCODE project has been published, and it's just mind-boggling. The ways, the multiple ways that DNA is read. It's read in multiple directions. It's spliced. What is read then is spliced in multiple ways, and the implication is that essentially all the DNA is functional, and not functional in just one, in one reading sense, but in multiple senses.
Yeah, it's as though, now you're a programmer from way back. Do you remember Dr. Baumgartner, the idea of self-modifying code? And that was poo-pooed by the software industry because you want to separate your code from your data and keep things nice and orderly. The things that are going on with, by the way, I worked for Microsoft for a year in their networking department. The things that are going on in DNA at a programming level are so wildly complex that nothing human beings have ever done even comes close to equaling its complexity and sophistication.
We were had a little brainstorming conversation here at ICR this morning, just this morning, speculating how much computer power it would take to do the data compression algorithm that seems to be operating in DNA. How one could go about compressing data and such that it can be read multiple ways and multiple layers in effect of coding. And we speculated that no human computer would be able to code and decode this kind of complex algorithm.
Now, right. And when you talk about coding and decoding, you're talking about logic and symbolic logic.
Exactly.
And I think about when our eyes receive photons and we interpret that data that's going into our brain. And once it gets into our brain, it doesn't look anything like the scene we're looking at. It's just, it looks like fuzz. It's just digital data, basically. And the laws of physics, they don't have any symbolic logic functions. Unless I misunderstand the laws of physics, they have no logic functions, so that it is a different kind of thing to operate at a genetic level.
Right. What we're talking about is another category of reality apart from matter and energy. We're talking about the realm, a non-material realm of language, which involves symbols, assignment of meaning to symbols, and then the application of rules to combine these these primitive symbols into a more complex structure. And so we're talking about something abstract, something that does not depend upon matter, molecules, photons, or anything. It's a part of the abstract category of reality. Yet it's probably the most important aspect of the reality that we experience.
Yeah, for years here at Bob and Yurt Live, we've pointed out that life is not really carbon-based. That's a level too high. Life is information-based.
That's correct.
It's information-based, and, you know, conceptually, theoretically, God could implement life with different forms of matter, but it's information-based. And so the laws of physics, they have no logic functions. They have no syntax, no vocabulary. And so for DNA to arise by the laws of physics is not possible. It's a different kind of thing. It's information.
It's in a different category of reality entirely.
Yes, information is not physical. And,
that's right.
You know, Einstein is often claimed by many sides in many ways incorrectly, and he was certainly not a creationist. In fact, he's not a theist even. But he did talk about an impassable gulf between the laws of physics and then the world of ideas. And he thought, this is an impassable gulf. How is it that ideas have ever come to exist? If we only have a physical realm of atoms and molecules, we should have never come to a reality where there are ideas, because that's not physical. That's knowledge, and that's exciting
right.
to me.
And actually, the laws of physics, the laws of physics belong to this category, this non-material category. So we have a linguistic description of the physical world. So language, which can only be the product, as far as I can understand, of a mind, language is what the laws of physics are represent.
That's right. Laws.
So there's a linguistic basis to physical reality.
Yeah, laws are descriptions. That's what laws are. They're descriptions of reality. And by the way, just something to throw in, I don't know if you thought about this issue, but pain itself, we think of pain as something physical, but pain is not physical. Pain is awareness. Pain is knowledge. And we think of experiencing pain in our brain, but our brain is the one organ that has absolutely no pain sensation. They operate on the human brain, and they don't have to give a local anesthetic because it doesn't feel pain. Pain is awareness, and awareness is a soul and a spirit issue, not an atoms and molecules issue. That's a fun topic in and of itself. One other thing, Dr. Baumgartner, I wanted to tell you about us. We, a couple years ago, had a debate with the Colorado chapter of Reasons to Believe, Hugh Ross's group, and we've been selling it ever since on a CD called The Age of the Earth Debate, and it went really well. We had a geophysicist that we were debating and a mathematician from CU up in Boulder, the University of Colorado, and it was me and a Christian high school science teacher against two scientists, and it went extremely well in front of a large audience downtown Denver. And here we are a couple of years later, we're still selling the debate, and they never did. There is a tremendous amount of evidence that the Earth is young, and it's exciting.
So, well, we're hoping to highlight that this weekend.
Okay, so it's Saturday at the Colorado Community Church, and this is in the South Denver area, right at Colorado Boulevard at Hampton, right on the south side of that intersection. And you could find out information about this by calling us at Bob and Yurt Live, 1-800-8-N-YARTS, or you could go to the local Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship website, that's youngearth.org, and they'll give you all the information you need to register for this event, or you could just show up 8 o'clock Saturday morning. It's $25 for adults, and it includes a box lunch and Some Call It Science by Dr. Henry Morris. So, John Baumgartner, we haven't said anything about what you're going to present, but and we only have another moment or so. Could you just give us an idea what you're going to talk about?
My presentation is concerns carbon 14 and the fact that it's not that widely known that carbon 14 exists in essentially all fossil material. And I will give some data from 10 coal samples we analyzed. Every one of them showed significant levels of carbon 14. These coal samples were selected to span a large section of the geological record, from near the top, conventional age of 30 million years, near the middle, roughly 100 million years, and closer to the bottom, 300 million years. All of them had approximately the same amount of carbon-14, which implies that the trees and plants that form the coal all lived at the same time and all were buried at the same time in the recent past.
Now, that is powerful information because kids who go, I went to public high school, millions of young people have been told that radioisotope dating is evidence that the Earth is billions of years old. And we ask high school and college students, how do you know the Earth is billions of years old? And it's sort of silly. It's funny. They say carbon-14. They were never even taught that carbon-14 only lasts for thousands of years, not millions. So our students coming out of our colleges and high schools don't even know that. But in reality, this is evidence that this stuff is all young because there shouldn't be any of it in the fossil record.
That's right. To help people understand that, I say that if the entire Earth, if you had a mass of carbon-14 equal to the mass of the Earth, carbon-14 decays so rapidly that if you had this a million years ago, by now there would not be a single atom of carbon-14 left. It would have every last atom would have decayed.
Wow. If the entire Earth was a block of solid carbon-14, it would all be gone in just a million years.
That's right.
And here we have things that are millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of years old, supposedly, and we find carbon-14 everywhere.
That's right.
And as I understand radioactive decay chains and all, there's not enough uranium in the crust of the Earth by a factor of about 10,000 to account for all the carbon-14 we find in the fossil record. Is that about correct?
Well, that's a somewhat of a technical point of where does carbon-14 come from. Today it comes from cosmic rays interacting with nitrogen atoms in the atmosphere, converting nitrogen-14 into carbon-14.
All right.
But another aspect of what we'll be talking about on Saturday is multiple lines of evidence that there was a large amount of nuclear decay during the flood. And the decay of uranium and thorium in granitic rocks in the Earth's crust would have generated neutrons, which in turn interacted with nitrogen atoms in the crustal rocks to produce carbon-14, which subsequently made its way into the atmosphere to raise the level of carbon-14 rather quickly after the flood to approximately present-day levels. But that's a more technical detail that I don't have time right now to, fill in, to give all the background for. But yes. So there's got to be to find any carbon-14 today and have it consistent with the old Earth. Somehow, you've got to have had a lot of recent carbon-14 produced, and so the old Earth people say, radioactive decay in the crust can produce carbon-14.
Right.
Yes, that's true, but at today's rates, it's so small that you can neglect it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 10,000 times to 100,000 times too little
to
account for the levels of of C14 that we're finding in things like coal.
Dr. Baumgartner, last thing I'd like to mention to you, we had a discussion with a well-known museum curator up in Montana, Jack Horner, who was the technical advisor on the Jurassic Park movies. And as you know, he found these soft tissue T-Rex fossils up in Montana, and they've been studied, and the world has been abuzz with news about these soft tissue T-Rex. And we suggested to him that, in fact, our church offered them a grant of $23,000 to carbon 14 date the soft tissue T-Rex find, because even though there could be groundwater contamination in fossils in the earth, it seems that a dinosaur fossil that still has soft tissue would not have been exposed to groundwater over millions of years, because then the soft tissue would have all mineralized and decomposed. And so we said, this is a perfect specimen to carbon 14 date, and here's some money. It's cost you a few thousand. Keep the $20,000 for your effort. And so far, he's turned us down.
Well, I've had some email, participated in some of the email exchange in that discussion of dating, of trying to get C14 dates on dinosaur bone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the problem, one major problem, you've already mentioned it, is the issue of contamination by modern carbon.
Right.
And so one has to be extremely careful in selecting material to date with radiocarbon.
That's right. And that's why we were suggesting this soft tissue T-Rex might be a perfect specimen. Any thoughts on that? Or you don't need to reply to that. I know scientists like to think about things before they just blurt out ideas.
Well, all I'm saying is that I wouldn't be too surprised if one got, well, my guess is that one would get an age of 30 to 40,000 years if one dated that sample with carbon 14.
Mm-hmm.
The problem would be that a critic could say, that level can easily be explained by contamination by modern carbon. You only need 1% modern carbon to give you that kind of age.
Right.
And I would have to say yes, on the other hand, if it gave a date of almost any age, I mean, it likely would, even if it wasn't contaminated, it would still give an age of about 50,000 years.
All right. Well, Dr. John Baumgartner, I want to thank you so much, and we're so looking forward to seeing you on Saturday. So we'll see you then. Thank you, Doctor.
You're certainly welcome. I look forward to it as well.
May God bless you.
God bless you. Bye.
Bye-bye.